You're listening to Security Nation with host Kyle Flaherty.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Security Nation. This is actually going to be episode number 8, I believe, depending on our production schedule. But I am joined today by Joel Cardella. And Joel and I first, quote-unquote, met, although we really haven't met in person yet, right around South by Southwest this past year in March, because I was giving a presentation at the event, and I was new to Rapid7, and I kind of just asked a general question if anyone had seen kind of marketing departments, you know, struggling with security and, you know, the marketing being kind of an inroad to that, and that started kind of the last few months of conversations that we've had around this topic, and I figured, hey, that's a great idea. So, Joel, welcome. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So, like I said, and we're going to go all over the place, I believe, on this pod in general, but let's start with the whole marketing as a threat, or marketing as maybe open risk, if you will. I'm a marketer. I've run marketing departments. I run a team here overall. And at the same time, we've seen all of the stats that say the CMO is now the biggest tech spender in a lot of big enterprises. So that means they have a bunch of different, you know, products and solutions. But is, are you saying, from a security expert standpoint, do you see marketing kind of as a risk inside the company from a security standpoint?
Yeah, you know, I think that security people tend to think that anyone in the business is a risk doing anything. And they have this weird way of really seeing things in absolutes. Like they'll say, you know, this technology is secure and this technology is not secure. And then in a sort of weird paradox, they'll then admit that security is very complex and there's no one solution that can comprehensively deal with all of these security issues that we face. So it's kind of a loaded question to say that, I think, especially when you ask a security person. But I tend to think myself just a little bit differently because I grew up in the business and moved into security. So I see things with a slightly different eye when it comes to business risk, right? And so for me, I kind of boil everything down to that risk equation and say, you know, here we have a bunch of marketers and they're trying to do this cool job. And without their job, you know, the business that I'm in is not going to flourish as well. And so I want them to do their job. I think that's a good thing. I think it's very interesting that you note that there are some of the biggest tech spenders out there because I have seen some of the marketing technology that's out there. And not that I even really understand it, but I do definitely understand the leveraging of scale. And so when you look at marketing technology and bringing stuff to the masses, I can completely see how, from a security perspective, that would kind of freak somebody out and get out of control really fast, especially with data that you were, you know, considering sensitive, right? I've worked with folks that are nonprofits, for example, and the most important thing to a nonprofit is their donor list. And it's something that they want to protect because that's their donors, that's their bread and butter, that's the people giving them money. But at the same time, they want to do these targeted market opportunities to these donors. And that means they kind of have to share these donor lists with the technologies. And so with the deployment of things like cloud services or aggregation technologies, there's that risk where, you know, you're going to be releasing this stuff into the ether and where does it go? What happens to it? Does it present any higher risk in doing that? Or, you know, is the business risk worth it? I mean, I think these are all questions worth exploring.
Yeah.
But very, very interesting, too, at the same time.
Yeah, and I just don't know if, you know, I'll put on my hat just as someone who's looking out of his office right now at a room full of marketers and a room full of marketers that work for a security company, so we're probably a little bit different. But it's just not something that I think we think about a lot overall. And you brought up a point of, I want you to be able to do your job. When I gave this presentation last March, and I asked, this is a room full of CMOs, and I asked, you know, how many CMOs have actually met with their, you know, head of security or CISO, whatever the title was, and only one person out of probably 300 or so raised their hand.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and that to me was super sobering, but I think it's a concept of, I feel like they're just going to tell me no, so I'm not going to ask them.
Oh, absolutely. That's prevalent everywhere. you know, I have worked in jobs before where security was considered the department of no. And that's just the way it was. And I have worked with security people who had that mindset. And I think that there's probably still some entrenchment with that, especially if you think about kind of where security came from, right? We didn't worry about information security in the early days, mostly because there wasn't really value to the things that were out there in the early days, right? The only people who really worried about security were the military. So they had a very stringent mindset on data classification and what data classification was and who could see what, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that harkens way, way back before computer technology. And so I think that when you consider that is kind of the genesis of the information security as we see it today, it makes sense that people think of it that way. But in the new generation of information security people, I think that they're starting to realize that it's not that cut and dry. You know, like I said earlier, they're tending not to see things in terms of these absolutes, and they're saying, oh, you know, if this has data in, or if this has value in one context and it has value in another context, then I'm going to have to think about things differently. I can't just kind of slap a unilateral gate around this thing and say, this is how this is being protected. And, you know, it's a precious resource that can only be accessed on the third Wednesday at 3 o'clock. Right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you look back at, you know, obviously you've had a varied, you know, career of being kind of on the inside, IT manager, you've managed SOX, it looks like you've done a lot of things where you had to deal with the users. Mm-hmm. How did you break out of that department of no mentality, or when did it, or have you always been kind of outside of that framework?
Definitely have not always been there. Definitely was one of the department of no people, because, you know, when you first start to learn about this stuff, nobody really trains you on the business aspects of security. And that's changing, because I've actually seen now some security training that is focused on business type security rather than, you know, back office or you know, system side security. But I think that when I was first learning about it, that's just the way it was. It was very specific. It was very rigid. Again, kind of revolving around this concept of data classification, where certain data is restricted to only certain people, and that's just the way that things were. When I really started to learn about it was when I was managing a very large ERP, and from a three-letter German company that owns all the ERP in the world now. And that particular system has very strict rules that go down very, very deeply into the system on what you can do with the data. So you can literally open it up to everybody, or you can restrict, you know, very specific elements. It's very, very granular, the security in SAP. It's very nice, actually. And so what I learned about it was when I started to impose some of these security rules around the data, and applications started to break. And so the business would come and they'd say, well, my application is broken. And we'd look at it and we'd go, we don't really understand why it's broken. You know, it's all we're doing is saying, you know, you're a salesman, you're not allowed to look at HR data. But it turns out that it's way more complex than that, because this data, while it may be considered sales data in one context, now it's considered HR data in another context, and now it's considered financial data in another context. And you go, oh, yeah, we sort of have to start really thinking about these different scenarios. So the really cool thing for me was when I started to interface with the business and I started to understand the context in which they were using their data. And that's what really kind of turned me around and got me to realize, okay, you know, I don't understand enough about business risk. I don't understand enough about business management to really do things with this. That was probably around 2010 or so. So it wasn't really that long ago that this little epiphany came to me. And so to get over that, what I did is I just started communicating. I started talking to them and going, what kinds of things are you doing? Show me how you do this. You know, let me see the end result that you're looking for, so that on the system side, we could run back and we could say, okay, we need to make it look like this, and kind of use that as a pattern going forward, and building business rules around the handling of data. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is you look at the business rules around the management of your data, and then you build your security around that, kind of versus doing it the reverse way, which is what we're used to in a security sense.
And in that case, you know, you were pushing yourself into the business and learning about how they were using it and all that stuff. And it seems like, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm going to put out a generalization. But for the most part, you don't necessarily see a push or a pull from the departments as well, because either they feel like, oh, they're going to say no, so I'm not going to talk to them, like we already just said, or they just don't even understand, or maybe even don't even know who to go to.
That's really what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's the unknown unknowns. I'm starting to realize this more and more, that this is really the issue. You know, you can't blame the business for not knowing something, right? For not knowing what they don't know. And you can't really blame security for not knowing what they don't know. But I think you can blame them both for not talking to each other to figure that out. And this is really what the realization is why we have to communicate, why we have to come together, why we have to share these kinds of things, and not in a sort of cold scientific way, look at data as data and say, it is this thing and we'll classify it this way. And, you know, it can only ever exist in this context because, you know, I mean, context awareness is changing technology now, right? We have context aware websites, we have context aware e-commerce. All of these different things are happening to basically make these business moments that happen in our life. And when these business moments happen, we have to have the right context in order to take advantage of them. And the same would be true of data and anything else. So really, that context-aware security, which I have heard talked about in the past, but have never really seen realized in any way, shape, or form, I think it's starting to have meaning around it. And once you can assemble meaning around it, I think people can start to construct some meaningful rules and ways to benefit from it and ways to do it in a secure way. So, you know, again, you can take advantage of your aggregation technology, and at the same time, we don't have to give away the keys to the kingdom to do it.
Yeah, and I think part of it, too, is, and I certainly come at it from a different angle, just like you. I've been a marketer, but in security companies for the better part of 20 years. But I will say, as I got into the industry, and I know things have changed, but maybe not enough, and we should discuss that, but there's an intimidation factor when you're talking to security folks. There's a language barrier, let alone talking with IT, right? But when you talk specifically to security, and I think that is, I guess the word's off-putting, or at least just intimidating, from the standpoint of certainly, you know, someone in a marketing role or whatever, sales role or whatever it is, who wants to access that data and doesn't have necessarily a great argument for it. Right. And then closes themselves off. And so you mentioned communication. That's where I think, and it's why I think the topic that we've been discussing of marketing and security is an interesting one, but replace marketing with any department. And how do they better communicate and speak the same language? That, to me, is a huge challenge.
Oh, it's ginormous. I was just at an event where I spoke, and one of the very things I said is, you know, we only have ourselves to blame in security because we can literally have two paragraph sentences using 12 letters to communicate. Everything is an acronym and nobody understands. And the crazy thing about our acronyms is they have context too. You can say IDS to me and it can mean two or three different things depending on the context in which we're talking. And if you're somebody on the outside and you're hearing this, it is literally nonsense that you're listening to, right? Because you can't make heads or tails of it. So I completely agree with that. And I think that if there's blame to lay or fault to lay there, definitely the security world needs to understand that they need to increase their communicative capacities in more business type terms so business people can understand. But the same goes for the business too. I mean, I've had discussions with business people where they were saying things to me and I'm looking at them and I go, I think I understand what you're saying, but contextually I don't have a grasp. So I want to make sure. And that's when I say, you know, let's look at this and you tell me if this is the result you're expecting. So maybe proving out the concepts that you're talking about, you know, is part of that whole chain, right, where we have to determine this. But really, I think the thing that I would say is that is a barrier and it's a recognizable barrier, but it shouldn't stop us from asking the question. So if you're a marketer or if you're any other job other than IT, you know, insert here, and you're intimidated by your IT people, you got to tell them that. I don't understand what you're saying. Sometimes I think I've heard people say, you know, it makes me feel dumb.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't make you feel dumb. That's like me saying, I traveled to another country and they spoke another language and it made me feel dumb. It didn't make me feel dumb. I just didn't understand what was happening because I didn't speak the language or I didn't have the context or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing. It's if you need help, ask for help. You know, there will be somebody to help. There's always, you know, a couple of exceptions, especially in IT. We're known for being, you know, maybe on the fringe of social grace, but at the same time, you know, you can find people like myself and like others who are very open and want to communicate and want to be able to send these concepts and want to do good things. You know, I'm an enabler. That's really what it comes down to, is I see security as an enablement tool. It enables us to do business better. It enables us to do business faster and to do it in a way that is low risk, because at the end of the day, I'm managing risk. That's my job.
Right.
And so I want to be able to manage that risk to the best of my ability and to make you do to the best of your ability. And with open communication, we can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, part of what maybe has put us on a better footing, and by us, I am talking about marketers now, but I think this is true in other areas as well, is we're all much more fluent in technology and the use of technology than we were 10 years ago. We're, you know, that so many of us now, and certainly in my industry, have had to go and, you know, do things we never thought we'd have to do from a technical mm-hmm. standpoint, whether it was, you know, spinning up a VM, whether it's learning analytics, you know, learning R so you could actually do something, you know, across the data you have, like whatever it is, we're doing things more. And so I think that allows you to then at least come in with a similar, maybe it's not exactly the language, but it's a, you know, it's close enough that we can talk to each other, not at each other.
Yeah, that's really the key, right? The one-sided conversation is definitely the deal breaker. It erects more barriers really than it deals with. And again, you know, from my perspective, because I'm a communicator, I'm like, come at me, bro.
Right.
You know,
right,
whatever
right.
you got, bring it. Let's talk about it. Let's see if we can figure this out. Because the truth of the matter is, we may not be able to figure it out between us. We may have to go seek somebody else to bridge an understanding between the two of us, and that's okay too.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, and that brings up kind of, you know, when we talk about communication and we talk about, you know, security overall. One of the things that we've discussed in the past too is this concept, and I actually had Rebecca on the podcast probably a month ago or so talking about threat intel mm-hmm. and threat sharing. But for those, you know, who don't kind of understand that model, although most people who are listening to this pod do, but they might be kind of getting into the industry right away, you know, what is kind of that sharing of threat intelligence from a, you know, especially in your world as a security analyst? Why is it important, and really, what is it?
So the biggest thing with threat intel sharing is it's the us versus them scenario, right? Where we kind of break security down into two sides. We have the red team, we have the blue team, right? The red team are the attackers, and the blue team are the defenders. So the bad guys on the red team are going to be going after whatever they can go after, and the good guys on the blue team have to try to defend against that. And when you consider that one person who's an attacker can have access to massive amounts of resource at their disposal, computing cycles, intelligence cycles, they might have insider knowledge. This makes it roughly impossible for a person on the defense to be able to manage defense by themselves. So sharing of intelligence becomes huge when it comes to constructing proper defenses against these kinds of threats, right? And really, I'm not even considering advanced threats. You know, if we just look at the threats that are out there right now that we can load into Metasploit and run without any knowledge whatsoever, right? All we do is load a module and execute the function, and it goes and exploits these machines. It's really important for us to understand what actions are being taken, what's going on, which is what threat intelligence sharing is, right? What does the landscape look like? How does it change? I'm a member of InfraGuard, which is the FBI and Civilian Alliance for Technology, and the FBI will issue threat notices on current things that are happening with ransomware, for example. That's good information. Maybe it's information I already had. Maybe they give me something I didn't, or better yet, maybe I share it with somebody who didn't have it. And we're all benefiting from that. So really, it's the whole, like, it takes a village kind of mentality that we're building with threat intelligence sharing to stave off the horde, the massive hordes that we kind of face every day.
And do you feel like, obviously, you're a big proponent, you know, and those who I think have been involved with InfraGuard in the past, too, have that same feeling. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be, a fear about sharing these things as well. And I don't know if that's just fear of too much information being put out there, fear of looking like you're losing, fear of people taking advantage of that. Maybe it's all of those things.
It absolutely is. It's all of the above, and it's probably more. You know, there's the fear that you might reveal something that you know previously wasn't available. You know, this is the reason that the Isaacs came into being, right? The Isaacs got together, the financial institutions, and said, look, we are being hammered day and night. Every one of us is fighting the same fire. Sometimes we're fighting it from the same source. We have got to get together, and we have got to share some intelligence among ourselves to be able to fend off these threats. The Isaacs is a great idea. The problem with the Isaacs is that it's closed, and you have to be a member of the Isaac to get the information and to be able to do anything with it. But at the same time, that kind of gives them a powerful defense because they're able to construct some things in a way that if they opened it up to more people or opened it up to outside finance, might be diluted if they did that, right? So that small community does very well with their fraud detection and their anti-fraud technology because of threat intelligence sharing. And I have heard ideas floated in the past, although I don't really know where we're at with it right now, of forming more Isaacs around more industries where we can get together and we can, you know, share and determine this thing. When I was a CISO, one of the things that we would do is I would jump on a call that was roughly monthly with a bunch of other CISOs and a bunch of other verticals around the country. We're all Gartner clients. That's how we came together. And in the privacy of the teleconference, we would share the things that were going on inside of our companies. But the fear is, you know, we can't share these outside this circle because it would open us up to more exposure. But we have to have somebody to talk to, right? When you're a CISO, you're a pretty lonely person because you don't have peers that you can bounce stuff off of. You don't have somebody you can just pick up the phone and go, hey, if you're lucky enough to have a mentor, maybe, but even then, you can't always divulge to your mentor everything that's going on. So you know, a gathering of CISOs is like, you know, almost like a commiserating around the bar at the end of the day, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're pouring whiskey for everybody and going, wow, what was your day like?
Right.
Yeah, let me tell you about my day. You know, and that's as far as you can go because, you know, sometimes we're very raw, we're very vulnerable with these things, and it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard today when clients ask me, how do we compare to other clients? I can't really tell you because really nobody talks about it. I mean, that's the answer, right?
Yeah.
So it's difficult. It's a difficult thing when you talk about threat intel because I think what it is nobody's quite sure where the line is. Mm-hmm. Where do you stop, right? Where do you stop at good information and when does it become too much information? And then when does it go into I'm exposing myself and causing myself more of a problem than I would have had if I didn't?
Yeah. No, and it is. It's interesting because we've seen it grow in kind of bits and spurts, depending on what's going on overall. And I think the analogy to the bar is a good one. Of you know, then it becomes kind of you know, I caught this fish. This is how big it is, type of thing. And everyone just tries to top them, you know, each other overall. And it becomes maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not. But at least you were able to talk to somebody who is kind of in your space. Certainly feel that. But back to kind of InfraGuard too of the concept of, and this is another thing that we've heard a lot about, of public and private, you know, government basically helping and sharing a lot of this information overall. Is that something that continues to grow in terms of the ability and people more willing to maybe do that? Or, you know, and its use overall, or is it still kind of stagnant?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that in the number of years that I've been a member of InfraGuard, it's the information has been sporadic. A lot of it is self-generated. You have to go in and you have to search the portal. You have to find information. But I also have some connections to some special agents that are very good with giving out notices and bulletins. And that's the reason I bring that up is because that's kind of the problem with threat intelligence right now is what is the sharing model? Mm. Like how do I respond to it? Is it something that I have to seek out? Am I plugged into a news feed or is it something that's put in front of my face as a notification? You know, what's better for me? What's better for you? How do we make that work in a way that works for both of us? You know, some companies have security operations centers, some don't. Can they both benefit from the same intelligence? They're really, really hard questions. So I don't know that I really know how to answer that other than to say, I am somebody who believes that more information is better than less information.
Yeah.
So the more information I can have, especially if I can do something with it, that benefits me. That's a good thing.
Well,
right?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that goes to the concepts of standardizing the way that it's released. You know, yeah. You can talk about sticks and taxi and things like that, which, mm-hmm. you know, was all the buzz a few years ago, and now no one seems to talk about it. you know, and so, yeah, but you're right. There's no certain way of everyone knows this is the framework for sharing information. This is where you go, and this is what you're going to get. And then this is how you act on it. Because I think that's the biggest problem, too. Like, can I actually do anything with this?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, backing up a little bit, we were talking, you know, one of the things that I love to talk about on these podcasts is just folks who have been in this industry for a while. And you've kind of, you know, you've worked a bunch of different types of scenarios within IT, mm-hmm. from security and managing the overall concept of IT. But I'd be curious, too, if you're talking to someone now, which I'm sure you do all the time, but I want to be a security analyst. I want to get into this kind of career overall. What should folks be doing to kind of get started in this career path?
The first thing they need to do is seek out a community around them of professionals or amateurs that are doing this. This is when I did this, that's when I discovered that I really liked what I was doing. You know, I had been poking around it a little bit. I'd actually been involved with security more than I even realized in other jobs, just as somebody who wore that hat. Right. I had to. I was managing an application and I had to find a way to distribute secure passwords to users and create them in the system. And, you know, I managed it right within when I was in the healthcare space. I did that. But when I plugged into the community, that's when my eyes really opened because I went, wow, I didn't realize the broadness of the field until I started talking to other people. And I realized, wow, this spectrum is very, very large. And the only way you can really get that is to hear the experiences of other people. So, you know, I talked to people who were physical pen testers, for example. These are people who basically get paid to go and break into buildings. Like, that's their job. I didn't even know that was a thing when I was first looking at security. I was like, wow, that's really an interesting thing. I met social engineers, people who trick you for a living. Essentially, they're magicians, right? They lie to you and do what they say. that was amazing to me. And then there's the really technical stuff. In the context of security, you know, we kind of hear about hacking and popping systems, and that really that's only one small part of a very, very broad spectrum that this field has to offer. So my advice always, whenever somebody says it, is find your B-sides, for example. Security mm-hmm. B-sides that happen in every major town. They even happen in small towns now. What B-sides is it's people who just get together and they talk about security. Usually it's over a beer at a bar, but it can get bigger. Mm-hmm. In Michigan, we have MISEC, where we actually have formalized meetings. Those meetings have had 40, 50, 60 people, and there's always a presenter that's presenting some interesting topic of something, of some sort. Or there's a panel, or there's something going on. That's the most valuable way for you to determine what it is that interests you about this field. And then people can turn you on to different things. They can turn you on to new tools. They can turn you on to different resources that you might not have had access to. That's the first thing to do, is definitely seek out a community. There are conventions that happen all the time. You know, I just came back from DEF CON. DEF CON is probably the big one. It's the big daddy of security conventions. But there's a ton of little ones that happen, too. People do them all the time. There's lockpicking conventions that you can go to where people talk about security. So the message there, which you probably are well aware of, is network, yep. network, right? And build that network of people and connect with them and ask them what they do, ask them what they do for a living. They're more than willing to talk about it, you know, if they can. You'll find that it attracts an incredible variety of people, men and women of all shapes, sizes, ages, races. It's a very, very diverse spectrum. It's much more diverse, I think, than is kind of made to be out right now. When you can connect with these people and you can talk to them, they can give you details that you may not have had before. Security training is always a good idea. There is security training out there. It gets you to learn about things that you may not have had access to. And then the other thing that any hacker will tell you is they just want you to poke around and have fun. So download Kali Linux,
yeah,
load up Kali and start running some tools. Yeah. There's tons of tutorials out there. There's YouTube videos. I mean, there is a dearth of resource for you right now to be able to move into this space and play around and do things. The only thing I caution you there is just be aware that you should not be tampering with other people's stuff. That is a violation of the law.
Yeah.
So anything that you want to do in terms of like playing around in the space, play around it in your own space, your own sandbox, right? So you have a computer, or better yet, you have a VM that you can go in there and you can just knock the crap out of and try to hack and try to get shell on Metasploit community. You can download that for free and you can run exploits against your VMs and learn.
Yep. No, and I think your point too about the smaller local ones, I mean, that's how I kind of, you know, learned as much as I did, especially when I moved to Austin. You know, and it could be five people,
sure.
You know, up to whatever, 30, 40, 50. And then, of course, there's the big shows overall. Mm-hmm. But those could be a little overwhelming for newbies, for sure. So find the local one overall. And if you can't find a local one, there's definitely an online community.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, you bet. I mean, they do stuff all the time. And like I said, the amount of content that's out there is amazing. You know, DEF CON's a good example. For example, I don't know if people know, but you don't actually have to go to DEF CON to see the talks that are presented at DEF CON.
Yep.
Those are all published for free
right
after the con. In about a month, you'll see all the DEF CON talks hit YouTube, and you can go and watch them.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty interesting stuff out there. I'll give you one. There was one that I watched. I actually watched this in person, but then I watched online a few times after that. A guy by the name of Chris Rock, who by his own joke says he's not the black comedian because he's a white Australian guy. Pretty funny. But he has a talk out there called I Will Kill You, and it's all about how the law can't deal with people who have been marked dead but aren't really dead. So you can issue somebody issue a death certificate against somebody, and they have a really, really hard time in terms of property law and other things, basically proving to the courts that they're alive once they have a death certificate.
Sure.
That's all part of this whole thing that we call security, right? Yep. Because it just happens to be loopholes in the law. He did one this year. I haven't caught it yet. I'm going to catch it when it comes out, on basically how to overthrow a country using legal loopholes. Mm. You know, I mean, it's crazy stuff. So that kind of stuff is out there too. So if you can't get to those kinds of conferences, you can watch the conference material. It's all out there.
Yep.
Just search for it. It's all basically YouTube channels that you know, run it all.
Exactly.
And it's generally not censored. I mean, it's core content.
Yep. No, I mean, you know, DerbyCon was live on YouTube the entire time.
Yeah, so live streamed. Yeah,
I love
that's right.
That was, you know, because I couldn't go out, but I could at least have it on one monitor and just be checking out what people are doing. So mm-hmm. let me ask one last question. You know, we've talked about a lot, and actually it's perfect because you just talked about pen testing and social engineering and, you know, popping systems, whatever it is that you get into. But I'd be interested in your role now, kind of what areas of risk you're most like salivating on. Is there something that you're like, man, here's the new frontier, or, you know, like what gets you jazzed up? You've been doing this for a while now, but you obviously love it. You know, there's got to be things that get you really excited.
Yeah, so I'm a slightly different animal. I am really jazzed up at the human factor, the human side of what goes on. And I am fascinated by human behaviors. My degree is in organizational management, which is basically HR, right? I have a master's degree in that, but I do security because I'm just fascinated by how much we're influenced by human behavior. So even when you see things like computer code, right? Computer code is something that we tend to think in very technical and sterile terms, but at the end of the day, it was created by humans, which means it's flawed. In some way, it's flawed. And somebody is going to discover that flaw. And it's probably due to some weird behavioral issue because, you know, one person was lazy about something and said, I'm going to take this shortcut when I create this thing. And it, you know, it's not the code that fails. It's the behavior elements. So I'm really looking right now at how humans are influencing this whole thing. And as we move into these new frontiers, you know, VR being like the big, big next revolution, right? Like this is going to be really big. Everybody can see it coming. How does human behavior influence VR? How does it influence how we look at VR? How do we secure something like that around human behaviors when it basically changes our perceptions of what the world is, mm-hmm. right? So I guess I'm more of a philosopher than anything. That's That's what I look at as like the philosophy of the stuff. But it fascinates me. At the end of the day, it absolutely fascinates me that, you know, we've got systems that were built by humans that are you know, owned by humans, that are managed by humans, that we try to write rules around human behaviors for which we really can't do. And, you know, we roll this into a complex security equation and say, well, how do we secure these systems? I guess at the end of the day, it's don't let humans use them or ever work with them. Right. That's the only answer. Right. That's the big red button is only machines are allowed to do machine security. But then humans, they have no context. They don't get to use them. So cool stuff doesn't happen.
Right.
So that's really where I am with that. But I think that, you know, from a technology standpoint, like I said, VR is going to be huge. IoT is ridiculously big, right? The amounts of data that we can get back from stuff now is just amazing. I used to work with some guys who have gone off and they manage IoT basketballs now is their company. So the coaches use these things to determine how the players are performing on the court by measuring all the data measurements of the ball.
Wow.
I couldn't even, yeah, it's fantastic stuff. Like I couldn't even imagine something like that would exist. That is so unique and unusual to me.
Yeah.
So when you start to see these kinds of technologies and you see how it's being applied, like it makes the new frontier everywhere,
yeah.
Literally everywhere. Everything can be turned into, you know, some data producing object. So now that we have the data, what do we do with the data? How do we make it into something? And then if the data becomes valuable, which then attracts the attention of bad guys, how do we secure that data,
right?
How do we make it so it's okay, right? I don't know. These are all really big questions and will probably far outlive me, but
yeah,
definitely fascinating.
They definitely are. And it's funny though, because it all comes back to that human element, which we talked about kind of at the beginning of, you know, you got to go and talk to your CISO, you got to go talk to your security person and vice versa,
yep.
Right?
We got to be
talking about these things. And I think that if there's one thing I like to look back on in the last, you know, 20 years at least in security is that, you know, here we are today, you and I having a conversation about this. And that's important. And that's a good example of how this has to happen from a, you know, yeah. I guess I'm waxing philosophical as well. You know, but I think, that is critical. So Joel, thank you so much, for this time. It was super interesting. Really appreciated, your time here on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Excellent.
And I'm looking forward to talking to you more in the future about cool stuff.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And the next time we will definitely do this, soon. So thank you all for, listening, and until next time.